last case of the day, which is 072722, and it's Saeed versus Mukasey. That's Mr. Tenbrook. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. James Tenbrook on behalf of the petitioner. As you know, this case is a petition for you from the denial of the immigration judge and the BIA of a request for withholding of removal. This is an unusual case, but I think the main questions are, you know, whether the petitioner suffered persecution and whether this persecution or fear of persecution arises to the type of claim this court is willing to recognize. As you know from the facts that this gentleman was compelled to marry a person, a woman of his sect, the Madavia. He resided in Hyderabad, where the Madavia have a considerable amount of control. He sought to leave town. He expressed an objection to marrying her, and when he did, by saying that he wanted to meet her and talk to her before the marriage, they wouldn't let him, and then he said that he didn't want to marry her, in which case they threatened to exile him, and he did get married after that. Now, after being married to her, he tried to leave town four different times. The most notable time was when he went to, I believe it was Calcutta, and there were about 20 persons from the Madavia sect that showed up to the store he was working at only after a few weeks, and they gave him a ticket home and told him he better go back, otherwise they were going to kill him. And turns out as well that it was a question that I had when I first was talking to him was, well, how did they find out where he was at? You know, India is supposedly a very, very big country. How could you find somebody there? And he said, and I do cite it in the brief, but he said that essentially they have a system where, you know, if you're living somewhere, the police are going to know where you're at because they have some system of registration. If you check into a hotel, if you get an apartment, eventually they're going to find out where you're at. And because there are adherents, you know, to the Madavia and all throughout the country, you know, they're eventually they can find him. And he testified to that. And I suppose I should note as well that the immigration judge at no point, you know, ever said that he found the testimony of the petitioner to be incredible. He said he did believe him, but as a matter of law, the judge felt that he did not establish persecution. Now, with respect to the type of claim that the petitioner is making here, I would hope that it makes no difference whether it's a man or a woman. As we know, the law should be applied equally. And besides being forced to marry, he was not permitted a divorce either. So, in my view, it appears that, you know, this is a not being permitted a divorce is just as bad as forcing somebody to marry, because it's, in this instance, forcing somebody to remain married. Now, in looking for some support on this issue of whether forced marriage is the type of claim a court could recognize, there is a decision of Joseph out of this circuit in which this court recognized a claim of changed circumstances from a Pakistani woman who asserted that if she were to return, her parents were going to compel her to marry somebody that she didn't want to marry. And I should note that in other, I think out of the Second Circuit, there's a case, I think it's Xiu, I'm probably pronouncing it incorrectly, but X-I-U, where I believe they spoke about how we're not going to recognize a forced marriage unless it's in the circumstances where it's being sold into marriage. I would hope that in this court, in evaluating this type of claim, wouldn't give that too much weight. I mean, in my the way I see it, being in a forced marriage is bad whether you're compelled by having been sold into it or, in this instance, having been compelled into it by the religious community.
Is your problem is that the government tolerates this or what? Because when you have family imposition of whatever, the in-laws get mad when he dissed the wife, the wife, and then they force him to come back. Where is the government compulsion here? It seems to me this is a very unfortunate family and maybe religious situation.
Well, my understanding is that in India they don't have quite the separation of church and state that we have here. And in Hyderabad, which is predominantly a Muslim town, anything that the essentially the religious sect there wields political power. I think first of all, to address your question, and then secondly, and I talk about this extensively in the brief about how, you know, when he tried to reach out to the police, you know, showed their inability and unwillingness to help him.
Now, this is in defending him against the in-laws.
Well, defending
the father. I think when the father got beat up or been trying to get a divorce, the in-laws went after him. When he was threatened with, give him the train ticket, come back or else, that's the threat. He reported something to the police, said, well, you weren't bleeding or something or other, so they didn't think it was necessary to intervene in the family fight.
Well, Judge, I can tell by your question that you may be inclined to view this case the way the government has, to see it as a family fight or it's the in-laws. But I think that, and I actually went through the record to show in what instances my client testified to where he said it was the Madhavi community elders who were behind this.
So we should look at them as the governing body. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is correct, Judge. Or at least maybe not the governing body. I'm sure that they have some separate governing body there. But
the police, I assume, come under some other jurisdiction.
Sure, right. But given the given examples of other regimes in the Middle East where, you know, the religious elders, for instance, in Iran, are hold political power, I would think that the way they're doing it out of Hyderabad are probably somewhat similar, and that we should carry no presumptions here because we have separation of church and state. You know, they probably don't. So I guess I'm going to reserve.
And is that true throughout India?
It's
a pretty big country.
Oh, I know it is a big country. I don't know. I just know that. Well, the rest of India. Well, India is not all Muslim. I mean, India is part. I don't know. At this time, I'm losing what the rest of it would be. But I know that in Hyderabad, that is a Muslim town, and so. At least there.
And his parents continue to live there.
Yes. But not without being harassed. I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Elliott.
Thank you. Good morning. In police court, my name is Stephen Elliott, and I represent the Attorney General. As was already noted, this case is only a withholding of removal case. And this is a case about a dispute that arose because petitioner was in a marriage that he was not happy in. And the court should deny the petition for review because the record simply does not compel it to come to a conclusion that is different than the agency's determination that petitioner was not eligible for withholding of removal.
But isn't this a case where the unwillingness of the police to deal with threatened or actual violence has been established? When he appealed to the Chennai police, for example, he was told that the police would not intervene unless he had some blood coming out from his body. And there are other examples of this indifference. What confidence can we as a court have that the Indian authorities will protect him from private violence if he is returned?
Well, I'd first like to note that you are correct that in one instance in Chennai, he did attempt to report the incident to the police. But in the local community where he grew up, in Hyderabad, where he lived his entire life, there is no evidence in the administrative record that he attempted to gain this protection of the local authorities there in Hyderabad.
Well, on another occasion, it would seem from the record that local authorities demanded a bribe from his parents in order to entertain their grievances. And after they received payment, they took no action.
That's correct. After petitioner had already left India, when he was already in the United States, he testified that his parents did have to pay a bribe to have the local authorities protect or come into their defense. But he did not testify, or it's unclear whether he ever attempted to gain their protection, whether he went to the police with a complaint and they said, no, we're not going to protect you because you haven't paid a bribe, or whether he just presumed that they wouldn't protect him without paying a bribe. And the record is unclear on this point.
But
and
the parents paid the bribe. I'm missing something.
Oh, you're correct. The parents, petitioner did testify that his parents paid a bribe some years after, at least 1 year, I'm not exactly sure of the time frame, after he had already left. But the point I'm trying to make is that petitioner himself, prior to this incident with his parents, the record does indicate that he himself attempted to gain the protection of the authorities. It's unclear whether, as I already mentioned, whether he asked for their help and they refused without the bribe, or whether he just presumed that they would not help him. I don't think this court should make that presumption that the authorities themselves are unwilling to protect him. And also, it should be noted that as it relates to his past persecution claim, he must demonstrate a number of factors, including that the incidents in the past, in fact, rose to the level of persecution. And he has not done so. Petitioner bases his claims on a series of incidents of threats and harassment, but this court has consistently acknowledged that persecution is an extreme concept, and that harassment does not rise to the level of persecution, and similarly, that threats do not ordinarily rise to the level of persecution.
I'm having a little bit of a problem with your argument, because in your brief, you note that after his parents sought a divorce on his behalf, they began to receive threats of violence, you know, from the wife's family, and they arrive and they threaten the parents with violence, and they beat and punch the father so that he required medical attention. The police show up. They tell them to go to the station to file a report. And if they want protection, then they have to pay more. And then they pay the police 10,000 rupees. And then the family wants $34,000 of United States currency. And the parents agree to pay this sum, but harassment still continues. I mean, how can we have any hope that he's going back to anything but horror that the police will not help him with? If anything, they're going to ask for more money.
I guess I'm just trying to lay out petitioner's argument and not to conflate the two parts of his argument, one being that he suffered past persecution, and the other being that it is more likely than not that he will be persecuted in the future on account of a protected basis.
It sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
Well, assuming, arguendo, and this, we are not conceding this point, that the authorities have shown an unwillingness to protect petitioner's parents, he still has not demonstrated that it is more likely than not that he will be persecuted on account of a protected basis.
But it's him they're trying to protect.
Excuse me?
His parents are being punished because they're trying to protect him. So wouldn't you go from A to B? In other words, if he goes back, he's going to have problems.
I mean, if that connection would be made by the panel, but again, it's not on account of a religious belief. It's on account of a personal dispute that arose because petitioner left his wife on 4 or 5 separate occasions. He was involved in a marriage that he was not happy with. His wife had an undisclosed medical condition that he was not happy with.
Well, but forgive me for interrupting, but on top of everything, he's now converted to Sunni, so... So we do have a religious problem.
Well, you're correct in that petitioner also bases part of his argument on his change from the McDavian sect of Islam to the Sunni sect. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that any change in sects of Islam would actually cause, more likely than not, that he will be persecuted upon return to India. There is nothing in the record to substantiate that. And although it may be a subjective fear of his, it is not objectively reasonable based on the administrative record itself. He makes this accusation, but it's not in the record, and we have no basis to assume or that it's more likely than not. Again, this is a very high threshold that he'll be persecuted. And this court must be compelled to that conclusion. It's not enough that to look at the record and see there might be a different conclusion. It must, in fact, be compelled to that conclusion under the substantial evidence standard.
Well, I'm feeling compelled at this moment.
Well, I just would also like to note briefly that petitioner suggests in his reply brief that an alternative standard of review applies, something other than the substantial evidence standard. He did not raise that in his opening brief, and in fact, he concedes that the substantial evidence standard applies in his opening brief. And therefore, it was outside of the scope of his opening brief or our answering brief. And that being said, this court has consistently acknowledge that the substantial evidence standard does apply when it's reviewing an agency's determination to deny withholding a removal claim. Just one brief point.
Just real quick, remind me who the judge was in this case. What's this?
I apologize. I do not have the agency decision before me.
Judge? Yeah. Oh, Judge Cuevas. Thank you.
Just one more short point. Petitioner also had the burden to demonstrate that he was be unable to relocate within India. As the panel has already noted, India is a large country. And at one point, he was able to live in New Delhi for 5 months without incident. And he has not carried that burden of proof, has not demonstrated that he'd be unable to relocate within
India. 5 whole months without incident.
If the panel doesn't have any further questions, I would just like to conclude by saying that the petition for review should be denied because the record evidence does not compel it to come to a different conclusion.
Thanks, Mr.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Tembro, 2 minutes.
I think all the issues the government raised have been adequately addressed by the petitioner in his reply brief. But I will. The government suggests that because the petitioner himself did not make a complaint to the police in the town of Hyderabad, that somehow that this indicates that he would be protected in Hyderabad. Well, the petitioner has presented evidence that the police in other cities were unwilling to protect him. And for the government to make that suggestion and to infer that somehow in Hyderabad he'd be safer, I think is absurd. So, now, with respect to the change of sect, and I suppose it would be, it's partially true that it's a subjective fear of his, but it is, contrary to what the government just stated, on page, at the record, on page 133, the petitioner testifies that the clerics in the Madhavi clerics are aware of his change of sect, and that essentially they have told his parents that he made a big change, he made a big mistake, and then when he comes back, they want to see him, and it's the petitioner's view that if he goes back, that you know he's definitely going to be punished in some way, if not killed. Now, with respect to the government's argument that he was able to live in New Delhi without incident, you will also see that the record establishes that he had to live on the outskirts of town, and essentially he had to live in a hut in order to not be detected. And in the portion of my brief where I discuss that, there's case law that says living as a fugitive is no way that one should be compelled to live. And finally, with respect to the standard of review that I challenge in the reply brief, the point that I'm making in the reply brief, in case it's not clear, is that upon reading the government's brief, it appears as if they're conflating this court's review of the facts and the law under the same standard, when essentially the statute, as it was amended in 96, says that questions of law are reviewable under the manifestly erroneous standard, while questions of fact are viewed in terms of any reasonable adjudicator being compelled to conclude to the contrary. And I think the government conflated both by saying, you know, both have to be reviewed in terms of being compelled to the contrary. So that's my only point with respect to that. If there's no other questions, I'll be seated.
Well, thank you, Mr. Tenbroek. Thank you, Mr. Elliott. And the case will be taken under advisement. And this court will be in recess.